ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more. He was the man who stole the plans for the atomic bomb. A brilliant physicist, a devoted communist. A spy hiding inside the most secret project on Earth. This is the story of Klaus Fuchs, a man who believed he could serve two masters, science and the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, Damien Carrick with you on ABC Radio National, leading the national conversation on legal stories and cases. Today on The Law Report, we're looking at how the language and cultural expression of racial minorities can end up before the criminal courts in the UK. And a warning, we will be discussing the use of offensive racial language. In England, charges were dropped against a 22-year-old black Muslim woman, Jamila Abla, who used the N-word in a tweet about a black soccer player. The decision came just weeks after the high-profile acquittal of Australian soccer star Sam Kerr on charges of racially harassing a white police officer in February last year. Last March, I spoke to Jamila Abla's legal counsel, London barrister Ife Thompson. She says the two cases raise serious questions about how decisions are made to prosecute racial hatred offences. Ife Thompson, tell me about Jamila Abla. Who is she and why was she charged with sending obscene communications under the Communications Act?
She was a young black woman, full of life, never been in trouble with the police before, never had a conviction, never gone through the court system, who, just for writing on Twitter as somebody who's a fluent speaker in Black British English, found herself being dragged to court and being dragged through the criminal legal system, or some say the criminal punishment system, simply because of the way that she spoke for using the N-word on social media.
It was a comment about the game performance of a black British soccer player, Alexander Isak.
That's correct. So my client was watching the game live. She was talking to another black person based in the USA, who is also a speaker of African-American vernacular English. And they were having an exchange about the football match, as people do when watching football. And they communicated in a way which is quite natural for them, which is to use AAVE terms, or as we say, Black British English terms, which incorporate AAVE. And AAVE is the abbreviation for African American Vernacular English. And in their exchange, they were frustrated at their football idol, Mr. Goal, and expressed dissatisfaction in that. But there wasn't any malice in that, and it was actually quite a jovial exchange, and my client saw herself being brought to court for that exchange. A content moderation sort of organization picked up the tweet and flagged it as racial abuse. And this is despite the spelling of the word being N-I-G-G-A. And I bring that to your attention because for AAVE speakers, they have reappropriated the N-I-G-G-E-R, which linguists would say is part of mainstreamed English, which is known as a racial slur. And they've reappropriated it with the spelling of the A at the end, which is now a term of endearment. It's a term to describe another black person. It can be a term to show, sort of love. So it's a reappropriated term that is used in the same way mainstream English speaker would use the word guy. Like, that's how the word is used. But my client, Jamila A, she found herself, because of that exchange and because of her language use being seen through the prism and the lens of white mainstream English, despite her being a black British English speaker and using it in the known AAVE definition and usage, and actually the way that they spell it, she was still brought to court.
So she was picked up, or this communication was picked up by an organisation monitoring for racial abuse of football players online. So how far did this prosecution go? Ultimately, the prosecution was dropped, but what was the impact on her, and how far did it go before the decision was made to drop the prosecution?
Yeah, so my client was at home one day and the police actually knocked on her door. her mum opened the door and told her the police are looking for you to do with a racial tweet, and she was absolutely shocked. So it went as far as the police are locating her to her actual house, her having to go to a police station and have a police interview. She then was charged. My client was extremely distraught. She was really, really, really upset. She couldn't believe that she'd been charged just for the way that she speaks. And she was really scared. That's the best way to put it. And throughout this whole process, it has been very laboring and taxing on her. You know, it's been something that she has had to worry about for months and have it looming over her head that she may be prosecuted and she may have a criminal conviction just because of the way that she speaks. But throughout this, Jamila's legal team had written to the CPS telling them they need to drop the charges. There was one letter that I wrote that was 23 pages explaining that the CPS code of prosecution test is not met. I made it clear that public interest test is not met and there wasn't enough evidence to charge her. We made it clear that this prosecution was a disproportionate interference with her human rights, particularly right to freedom of expression, right to a private and family life, particularly her linguistic rights. We made a very clear case as to why this prosecution should not go ahead.
And did the prosecution give its reasons for ultimately dropping the case just a week or so ago?
They gave a sort of generic response in their letter, and they just said that, you know, after further reviews, they no longer released a prospect of a conviction and they no longer are proceeding with the prosecution. That's what they told us.
Yeah, the Crown Prosecution Service at the CPS. It's really interesting. I saw an article in a magazine called Hyphen, and Jamila Abler said the following, quote, "I do believe that we can be prejudiced towards each other. We can be anti-black towards each other in the sense of the conversation people have about appearance, hair texture, colourism. But to say that I can be racist to another black person by saying the N-word casually is ridiculous," end quote. And she added, "Black people, especially young men and women and children in school, are policed and punished for the way they speak, regardless of where they are, whether you're in school, whether you're in work, and now this. It doesn't surprise me," end quote. I understand that there have been a number of other charges or similar style charges brought against people who are members of racial minorities. There was a case that actually did go to trial in court in London involving a lady called Maria Hussain. Can you tell me about that very briefly?
Yes, so she was a woman of Asian descent who, again, had her language use criminalised. The term coconut is used very often in racialised communities, in black and brown communities, to describe black and brown people that are actively doing the work of white supremacy. So in order to call out these forms of oppression enacted by people that look like us, black and brown people have come up with terms like coconut.
In November 2023, 37-year-old teacher Maria Hussain attended a mass protest against the Israel-Gaza war in central London. She carried a placard showing the faces of the then Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, and also the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman.
It was a satire placard, so it was literally an image of a coconut tree with coconuts that had fallen down, and then it also had a face of Suella Braverman and also Rishi Sunak amongst the coconuts.
So she was actually charged again for sort of a racial hatred offence, and I understand this went all the way to trial. Hussain was found not guilty by jury, I understand. There was another case involving a conservative British black politician who alerted authorities to a tweet posted on Twitter or X. He was having a heated conversation with an activist about a police shooting of a black man in the UK in 2024. Just briefly, what was that case about? And again, it led to an acquittal.
Yeah, so there was a shooting of an unarmed black man called Chris Cabot in 2022. He was shot directly in the head. And a lot of black people were really upset about this because it's the ongoing patterns of police violence and brutality to our communities, and that disproportionately sees black people dying in this country. And this Tory, he wasn't an elected MP then, but he was, you could say, in the political spheres. He wrote a tweet, I believe, that did really trigger the black community because it was quite dismissive to the issues at hand that were being raised around police violence towards black people, particularly the Chris Cabot case. And loads of black people called out the behaviour using terms that they often use to describe the behaviour that is harmful to the community en masse. And I believe that some people called him a coconut, some people might have called him a coon as well. And from what we understand of that case in particular, that particular person reported many Black people that had actually called him the word coon to the authorities. And they looked at the word coon within the white mainstreamed English version of the word as opposed to the reappropriated term that Black communities have given it. So in that case, that young person, or the person that you're speaking about, he went to trial and was found not guilty. But it's particularly important that there's actually been many other Black people that have gone to trial and been found guilty. So at the moment, there's still an ongoing issue. The community are saying that their language use is being criminalised unfairly, and it's not being looked at through the proper lens, and the way in which Black language speakers have used that word has not been properly, some will say properly argued in court, or properly understood by the courts.
The Independent newspaper reports that in the recent case involving a Twitter exchange between a Black conservative politician and a young Black man, the accused posted a raccoon emoji, which is widely understood as shorthand for a term the politician regards as a racial slur. The defence argued that the word should also be understood as a reappropriated term, an intra-communal insult among Black and Asian people to describe people from minority communities who are seen to betray the Black community in favour of white people or white culture. The Independent also reports that as part of the police investigation, the accused's house was raided, he was held in a police cell for 10 hours and had his phone seized. Ife Thompson says this is one of about 20 prosecutions involving the politician who complained to authorities. Now, coming back to the case involving the woman who tweeted the N-word, I asked her legal counsel, Ife Thompson, did the soccer star at the centre of this case make a formal complaint against her client?
No, he did not. And when we asked CPS to confirm that, they didn't respond to us, but we never had any witness statements or anything that's confirmed to suggest that he was offended. And you don't need to show a specific offence for that charge, but it still goes to show that the alleged person that would be aggrieved by being called that hasn't even come forward.
So this does show that there are complexities around language when everybody involved are members of racial minorities. Regardless of intent, if a member of a racial community who's on the receiving end of those words and those images is distressed or harmed, if they come from, say, another member of a racial minority, is that something that should be taken into account?
That can't always be the starting point, because if that is, then you will have people that are being weaponized against racialized communities, people that are Black and are brown, but who are doing the work of white supremacy, who are being able to enact racist, harmful ideologies and say things that are problematic. But because they are Black or brown, you can't use the term specific, like, you know, this person's being racist. People are like, oh no, racism is reserved to whiteness. So if the benchmark is what the aggrieved person believes, rather than looking at context and how communities en masse use language and how communities en masse use terms, then what you will have is an individualization of issues that doesn't look at what collective communities do. And I think then you have an issue where you actually ignore communities' languages and communities' ways of seeing the world. And that means they were not being seen. And then what you will have is the worldview of whiteness being the standard that is used in that space. Because if somebody is saying that you calling them a coconut is racism and it's white supremacy, and because they're a Black or brown person, that's the standard, when actually the term being used is to call out them doing behaviour that is contributing status quo, then we can't just use the person who is complaining as the benchmark, but we have to look collectively at what's the consensus and what was the collective community's thoughts and usage of the word, because the court system is still a very white space. You know, the way the world views and the norms and the practices of Black and brown communities are hardly in those spaces. So it's particularly important that lawyers running these type of cases do get experts that are familiar with these communities, world views, also language use.
But could you be a member of a racial minority and still feel enormous offence or distress about the use of those terms against you, even by, well, obviously, perhaps it makes a difference if that person is, the person using those terms is not a minority, but if even if your person is a minority?
I think if the person is not a minority, then it's a different question in hand, because again, those words have specific meanings outside particular groups' language use. And some words still today, like if a white person says the N-word, you know, that's a racial slur. So I do think that context is particularly important. And I'm not saying that somebody's going to be excited that they're being called a coconut. You know, it's something to call you out for behavior that's not right. You're not going to be excited to be called that. But is it to a criminal standard? Should it be something that someone gets a criminal conviction for? No, it should not be criminalized like that. And you're criminalizing whole communities' language used to call out particular behavior that is harmful to the group collective because it reinforces white supremacy. And that is taking away a whole community group's freedom of expression.
We're having this conversation in the weeks following the acquittal of Australian soccer star Sam Kerr. She was acquitted on charges involving an aggrieved white police officer charged with racially aggravated harassment after she called a police officer a stupid white man. Ife Thompson, you have represented accused in similar circumstances where police regard themselves as victims of racial harassment from people who are members of racial minorities.
Yes, yeah, so I had a case of a young girl who was, I believe, 14 years old or 15 at the time, where she said the N-word because she's a fluent Black British English speaker. And then she corrected herself and said, actually, you can't be the N-word, but you could be a cracker. And she was brought before the courts for racially abusing a white police officer. We had to get an AAVE linguist to explain why both of these terms are not terms of racial harassment, and actually the origins of these terms, and why she, as a Black language speaker, could not have been racially harassing him. And on the day of trial, the CPS dropped it.
So this was a white police officer and she had used the term cracker? I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that term.
Yes, so it was a white police officer, my client, who is a Black child, used that term. And cracker is an AAVE term. It was a word used to call out white people that are sitting in a position of authority and as someone who is an oppressor. And it comes from the whipping the whip, and it made a cracking sound on slaves' back. So that's where it comes from. So it was a term used to call out white supremacy and whiteness in an oppressive exchange. And again, in that exchange, the white person was a police officer who we would argue unfairly arrested her.
Ife Thompson, finally, what do you want to see in terms of changes in the way that prosecutors approach these cases?
I think it's not only prosecutors, it has to be police, because in order for it to get to the prosecutor, the police have to investigate it. And the police haven't got a grasp of Black languages and brown language practices. They're going to always be investigating the wrong things. And the institution of policing in this country is still racist, you know. But I also think that some of this stuff is not to a criminal standard. I just don't even think that this is the right avenue for some of these things. And I don't think that the avenue that's currently being used to deal with issues of racism and white supremacy, it's not coming from a transformative justice lens that looks at the root causes of these issues and how to undo the harm. I think that the starting point should actually really be like, what are we trying to achieve with these laws? And how does the way we investigate these matters take things further in undoing the harm to those communities? And I also think for the prosecution, they need to have a specific guidance and training, particularly on Black and brown linguistic rights and looking at it from a linguistic justice lens. And actually then being able to say, actually, we don't actually know enough about this language to prosecute. Actually, we're not best placed. And giving it to an expert, you know, or really if the prosecution have a human rights approach to the way in which they look at these sort of things, there wouldn't even be prosecution. So I do think there needs to be something about going back to human rights centred decision making and ensuring that they're taking into account the human rights of language speakers.
London barrister Ife Thompson, who specialises in the intersection of law, racial justice, language justice, digital rights and human rights. Thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report about the case of Jamila Abla and other similar types of prosecutions. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So far, we've been speaking about racial hatred prosecutions of non-white people in parts of the UK and the complexities around the use of language and its meanings. Many of these same issues arise in criminal trials for gang-related offences, where prosecutors present rap music or drill music as evidence. A recent report by the University of Manchester found 68 such cases involving 252 charged individuals just between the years of 2020 and 2023. Abena Uwusu-Bempa is an associate professor of criminal law and criminal evidence at the London School of Economics. She's conducted separate detailed research of 50 such cases over a longer period that reached the appeal courts. Abena is also one of the founders of a group called Art Not Evidence. What are the characteristics of rap music or drill music that bring it to the attention of police and prosecutors?
Yeah, that's actually quite a loaded question because there's a lot behind that. But I guess one of the more obvious answers is the provocative content of some of the music. So drill in particular is a subgenre of rap which started to become popular about 10 years ago now. And it's known for its violent content and criminal themes. Drill artists are expected to put on this authentic persona. They rap in the first person about things like weapons, violent acts, drug dealing and gang conflict. It builds on many of the conventions of earlier gangster rap subgenres like Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg and so on. All violent. There is some positive drill, but it is sort of characterized by these themes. But it's not just the content, as of course, genres of music and forms of art that have extreme violent and provocative content, from heavy metal, country music, even opera. I think it also matters who's making the music. And in the case of rap in the UK and the US, at least, it's primarily young Black people who fit a pre-existing image or stereotype of, you know, a criminal or the violent other, so to speak. Rap has long been seen as threatening, as have Black musical genres and forms of expressions that came before it, you know, going back to the blues, for example. But since the inception of rap more than 50 years ago, it's been on sort of the police and law enforcement radar. It's been subject to surveillance, scrutiny and criticism. And it hasn't properly been recognized as an art form, you could say. Instead, it's blamed for glamorizing, even causing and inciting crime, even where there's no empirical evidence to back up these claims.
Amina, how and why is this evidence brought into a criminal trial? What's it designed to do?
Well, I mean, to really get to the why, you'd have to ask the police and prosecutors who are presenting it. But I can tell you about the way in which it's used. So it's commonly used to help prove that someone had a motive to commit a crime or the intent to commit a crime or that they have propensity for a certain kind of behavior or to behave in a certain way. So if it's a case of weapons offenses, for example, there might be lyrics that refer to using or possessing weapons, and that can become evidence of a propensity to carry weapons. We also actually quite commonly see the music being used as evidence of gang membership, especially drill music, which kind of capitalizes on societal fascination with criminal street culture and gangs. So that can easily become evidence of someone's gang membership, which can then help to prove motive, intention, criminal associations, and so on. Often the music isn't actually directly connected to or about the offence that the person is on trial for. So indirect inferences are being drawn, and this is being done sort of in defiance of the actual conventions of the music. Police officers typically work as experts in these cases, interpreting music and contextualizing it and suggesting that there are links between the music and the crime, or that they can tell us about someone's character, intentions, motive, and so on. And it can be lyrics which were written or performed by the defendant, whoever it's being used against, can be lyrics that are found in their phones or scribbled down on pieces of paper. But it can also be things like participating in music videos. So being present in a drill music video can easily become evidence of gang association, even without having written or performed any music. And in some cases, even engaging with the music, engaging with rap culture, sharing it, possessing it, somehow gets linked to gang membership or association.
Can you tell me about some of the cases you've looked at closely which you would say raise concerns about the appropriateness of allowing this kind of evidence to be introduced?
Yeah, so many of the really concerning cases involve presence or participation in music videos. We've actually had, of the cases that have gone to the Court of Appeal, I think there's about 20 where the use of the music was actually challenged on appeal. And only one of them has been successful. And this was a case called Alimi, and it's now more than 10 years old, from 2014. Two music videos have been presented as evidence of gang membership. He was simply an extra, sort of in the background of these two music videos. And the Court of Appeal actually said, that's not sufficiently relevant to be evidence of gang membership, and it's not fair to use it. And his conviction was overturned. But even since then, we have cases where being present in or minimal participation in music videos becomes evidence of gang membership. So to give a couple of examples, there is a case called Sode, I don't actually know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, a case that ended up in the Court of Appeal after Alimi. And this was a joint enterprise murder. A lot of these cases are what we call joint enterprise cases, where you have numerous people convicted of an offence, not necessarily because they committed the offence themselves, but because they are said to have assisted or encouraged it. One of the appellants in this case, who was said to have assisted or encouraged a gang murder, he had been in a music video 2 years prior, when he was just 14 years old, and said to be making gestures or remarks which were consistent with support for the gang allegedly involved. So even if that interpretation of the music video is true, I'm not sure how we can draw a reliable inference of gang membership that would help prove a motive for murder from the actions of a 14-year-old in a music video 2 years prior. Right? Even two-year-old previous convictions in some circumstances like that don't end up in court.
And look, any other interesting cases that you think can illuminate the use of this kind of evidence?
Yeah, another case which is really concerning, which actually hasn't been considered at appeal, or this point hasn't been considered at appeal yet, is a case from Manchester back in, I think it was 2016, where 11 boys were convicted of murder and manslaughter. Now, in this case, it was known who did the act of stabbing the victim, but they were all said to have assisted or encouraged when they gave chase to the victim, even though some of them weren't actually present when the stabbing took place. And to kind of link them all together and to create a motive and intention, the prosecution said this was a gang crime. They were all part of this gang called AO. And they relied on a music video, which had been created, I think, a year or more than a year before the offence, called AO, or Active Only. Three of the defendants had appeared in this music video as essentially extras, not really doing anything. None of them were rapping in the video, and none of those three were the person who actually committed the stabbing. And it turns out this video, like I said, it was created more than a year before the offence, filmed by a local university student and organised through a local community-funded youth centre. And yet that became central to creating this gang narrative and attaining this large conviction.
Very interesting. Abena Owusu-Bempa is an Associate Professor of Criminal Law and Criminal Evidence at the London School of Economics and a founder of the group Art Not Evidence. Thank you. Thank you for speaking to The Law Report.
Thank you for having me.
That's the Law Report for this week. A big thank you to producer Christina Kukolia and also to audio producer Tim Jenkins. Do follow the program on the ABC Listen app. That way you'll receive the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.